The Last Word with Matt Cooper.
It's Culture Club time. I'm delighted today. It's Sheila O'Flanagan is with us. She has written more than 30 novels. She has achieved sales of more than 9 million copies, which is a phenomenal amount. The new novel is The Honeymoon Affair. Sheila O'Flanagan, thank you very much for joining us. And there was many of us thinking when you gave it up that you were making yourself rich in financial services and you did even better writing books.
Yeah, well, somehow. Somehow the thing that you like doing most, you know, ended up making me more money, but it made me happier too. So that's the good thing.
Funny if we had Imre Tulls on the programme last week, who's somebody else who had a career in investment banking before he turned to writing as well.
Writes great books as well. I love his novels. But maybe it is something when your heart is really in it, you know. I don't know. I think I've been lucky, but I'm also glad that people have enjoyed the books.
And tell us about The Honeymoon Affair.
It's a novel of, you know, your life not turning out exactly as you thought it would do at the start of the novel. Well, just before the novel, everybody's in a great place. Charles is a Booker Prize winner. Izzy's about to get married. Ariel is an agent and she has great clients. But as the novel opens, Charles is suffering from writer's block. Izzy's wedding has been called off and Ariel is not managing to sign the writer she thought she was going to be able to sign. And so their lives all collide. And as they collide, they're kind of having to deal with, you know, the fact that your dreams don't always work out the way you thought they did. But maybe that's a good thing. You know, maybe further down the road, you'll adjust to the life you're actually living and not the life that you thought you were going to be living.
Are your stories driven around the characters or ideas and concepts?
I usually have a kind of concept at the back of my head, and then the characters are the ones that bring that to life. The characters are really, really important to me and how they react to things and how their own lives develop after the situation that I've put them in starts to also develop. So the concept in this is really, you know, feeling that you're finally in a good place in your life, feeling that you've got it all right, and then things not working out the way you thought.
Okay. I see you're taking a break from writing, are you?
I am actually taking a break from writing, yes. Yes.
Why?
I had a tough year last year. My mum and my sister passed away.
Oh, sorry.
And I kind of felt that I just needed time to kind of process that because I'm a very emotional writer and I put a lot of emotion into my books. And I just felt that this is an emotion I wanted to process for myself and just take a little bit of time and step away from fake characters and, you know, people that I was making up and just concentrate on the people that were closest to me.
How long will you step away from it, though? Because is there not a fear that if you stop for a while, you won't go back to it? Or does that matter at this stage to you?
Well, obviously, that's quite terrifying, in fact, you know. And people say, oh, well, and I'm quite sure you're only as good as your last book and people will forget about you and, you know, things move on. And that is true. That happens. But, you know, at the same time, I think I don't want to force a book that I'm not ready to write just because I feel I should do it. You know, I have always written because it's something that I have wanted to do and something that's important to me. And I just think at this moment in time, it's more important to, you know, concentrate on mental health and a bit of self-care and some family care as well.
Fair enough. Okay, let's go to your Culture Club choices.
Right.
And let's start with, will we ask everyone for the first single or the first piece of music that they can remember purchasing? Can you remember?
Well, it's nearly half a century ago, not entirely, but I know it has to have been a Gilbert O'Sullivan piece because he was my great hero of music when I was younger. It's probably Alone Again, Naturally.
Let's hear a bit of that.
No point in us remaining.
Waterford's Gilbert O'Sullivan, which may well have been the first Irishman to ever go to number one in the Billboard charts in the United States. He was a phenomenon at the time, wasn't he? And I think in recent years, people have sort of returned to appreciating just how good he was.
Yeah, I mean, he's done quite a few tours and released more music lately. And I think what I liked about him was the melodies were always beautiful and slightly complex. Not all of them, you know, were simple. Some of them were very complex, especially some of his earlier ones. And then the lyrics were brilliant. I mean, it's like listening to poetry, listening to his songs. So I'm delighted that he's actually making a comeback.
And if I remember rightly, he had the big head of curly hair on him too, didn't he?
Oh, he did. Although prior to that, he had a kind of little flat cap. Do you remember? He had a kind of little flat cap and a little, slightly bover boy look. But yeah, his fame really came with curly hair and a kind of an American sweater look.
Okay, right. Now, your favourite album is one that definitely has not featured previously on the Culture Club here in The Last Word. And I have to admit, I haven't a clue how to pronounce it, so you're going to have to do that for me.
Aranjuez.
I take your word for it.
It's the concierto, the Aranjuez. And it was a Spanish piece of music. And it's my favourite piece of music in the whole world. I think it's absolutely amazing. And this particular album is by Milos Karadaglić. Oh, now you've got me saying it.
Sorry, my apologies.
That's all right. Karadaglić. And he's playing with the London Symphony Orchestra. And I think there's just everything in this piece of music. There's a kind of a sensuality. There's rhythm. There's looking forward. And it's just a great sense of time and place, I think.
Okay, let's hear a little bit of this.
Played the piano when I was younger, and I was kind of, I wouldn't say brought up on classical music, but I prefer music to vocals. I like music on its own, and I do like classical music.
And do you have it on in the background when you're writing?
I actually don't have anything on the background when I'm writing because I can't have any sound at all. But if, you know, other times, you know, if I'm sitting around or, you know, if I'm reading, I can have classical music on, and I love having music on.
Okay, and then I think that brings me nicely. I was going to come back to band or artists in a moment, but your favourite gig would, I think, again, an act that would be well known for their use of guitar as well.
Rodrigo y Gabriela, who have taken kind of a lot of classical sounds and modernised them and, you know, just do such a great, great job and make it so lively and so interesting and so enthusiastic, and they're fantastic. I actually love their gigs.
You've been seeing them many times, have you?
Been a number of times when only here. I mean, I would love to go to see them in Barcelona or somewhere like that, you know, where I think you kind of get the entire feeling of it. But I have been lots of times here and they are fantastic.
Okay, well, this is taken from the Olympia Theatre, Rodrigo and Gabriela, in 2017. This is Tamakun.
Thank you.
Olympia, Sheila, is sort of getting up out of your seats to dance to that, but it is the type of music that would have you up and about.
Oh, absolutely. And actually, I was at that concert and people were standing up and jumping around. So,
okay. And you also had mentioned Ennio Morricone.
Yeah, I love Ennio Morricone as well. And it's a kind of an interesting thing. I suppose it's somewhat on the same theme, you know, of that Mexican Spanish vibe going on. I think his music was great as soundtracks to so many of those spaghetti westerns, where just enhanced the movie so much. So I was at his last concert here, which was amazing.
Now, favourite band or artists, and I see from my notes you still listen to Gilbert O'Sullivan, but you told us about your favourite playlist, which has what on it?
Well, I have the late Kirsty MacColl, who I think was just a fantastic singer and songwriter. Pink, who I love. Katie Lang. Rodrigo and Gabriel, of course. And a Spanish kind of jazz singer called Andrea Motus.
Okay, what's the common theme there?
There's a common theme. There's a little bit of a Spanish common theme, I have to say. But the also common theme is maybe female singers and strong female singers as well.
Let's hear a bit of Kirsty MacColl. Not perhaps what people might expect, but one of her own songs, A New England. A lot of people, Sheila, probably think of her Fairy Tale of New York with Shane McGowan, but actually I didn't realise that's a cover version of a Billy Bragg song.
It is, as far as I know, yes. Yes. My actual favourite song of hers is called In These Shoes, which is off an album called Tropical Brainstorm, which she wrote shortly before she died, I think, or was killed, we have to say.
Terrible incident.
Yeah. But she's so clever and she's... You know, her wording again. I do like when, you know, singer-songwriters who do great lyrics to their songs, you know, so, but also the music goes so great with the lyrics. She's fantastic.
Let's actually go to books, because what sort of books do inspire you?
Well, I always say that I'm inspired by anybody else who has written a book and finished writing a book, because I know how difficult it is. So I like a whole range of fiction, and I guess when I'm writing myself, I read things that are very different to my own kind of work. So I like kind of crime and psychological thrillers, but I also like historical fiction, and I like historical fiction, but I also like historical fact, you know. So, but everything that's written, every word that I read in some way is inspirational to me.
Okay. And the choice that you have, you said you had too many to list, but yeah, you gave us what you call a comfort book, which you said is anything by P.G. Wodehouse. Now, for those who are not familiar with that, English writer of the 20th century, wasn't he?
Well,
or is it even earlier?
Earlier. Well, no, 20th century, but he was born in the 1800s, and I can't remember actually what year he died. But his novels, people possibly would remember the whole Jeeves and Wooster thing. So his novels were written about young men in the 1920s and 30s, and so of a very aristocratic background. His use of English is phenomenal. I have never read anybody who uses English as brilliantly as he does.
In what way?
He's a comic writer. So obviously he is writing to create a joke, but he just uses the right turn of phrase for every single sentence he writes. And my favourite book of his is actually a compilation of golf stories. It's called The Golf Omnibus.
Why, are you a golfer or a golf fan?
I actually enjoy watching golf, but I'm not a golfer or a golf fan. But he nails the obsessive golfer, you know, and he just nails that whole kind of air, that life, that belief that golf is the most important thing in the world. You know, he writes about people doing a brisk 36 holes before breakfast and this sort of thing. One of my favourite quotes from that book is, you know, a golfer being put off by the sound of butterflies flapping in an adjoining meadow. Everything is so cleverly done and so witty. And I, you know, if I'm ever feeling down, I will read one of his books because it inevitably will make you laugh.
Well, let's get an extract from Ordeal by Golf.
Friars Heath Golf Club in the 30s. It's a summer's afternoon, and out on the terrace, the oldest member is sitting in the shade. A book lies unattended in his lap, for he's watching the younger generation hooking and slicing on the links below. Now a young man crosses the terrace and makes for the vacant seat next to his.
Excuse me, sir. Do you mind if I sit here for a minute?
No, of course not. Sit down. Sit down. Young Pierce, isn't it? I'd have thought you'd be out on the course by now.
I should be, but I arranged to play George Butterfield and the blighter hasn't turned up yet.
Well, how late is he?
Oh, nearly 10 minutes. This is the last time I fix a game with him.
Oh, come, come, my boy. Have you never been late for an appointment?
Not for anything as important as golf.
I dare say it's that new sports car of his. Seems to break down rather frequently.
Well, he should allow for that. I'll give him another quarter hour, then I'll go out on my own. Unpunctuality makes my blood boil.
Well, don't take your boiling blood onto the course, dear boy. If you'll pardon my saying so, you have a slight reputation for losing your temper on the links. Always disastrous for a golfer.
And if you'll pardon my saying so, sir, according to my father, you were not immune to irritation in your playing days.
I never lost my temper. Sometimes after missing a shot, I may have broken my club across my knee, but I did it in a calm and judicial spirit because the club was obviously no good, and I was going to get a new one anyway.
P.G. Woodhouse from, what is it called again?
The Golf Omnibus.
The Golf Omnibus. Okay, movies. You say you don't really have many favourite actors or directors, and you've plumped for a movie.
Mm.
Apollo 13.
Yeah, and I suppose not entirely for movie reasons, although I actually thought it was a great movie. But when I was younger, my dad was very interested in astronomy, and he took us out stargazing. He took us to Dunsink Observatory at the time, and I remember when the Apollo mission was happening, and he was with us. I mean, he woke me up for the first moon landing. We watched the launch of the Apollo missions together, and so when I watched that, I remember those times with him, and he sparked that real interest for me in the astronomy and the whole space mission thing. And so when I'm watching that, I'm reminded of him and reminded of his enthusiasm, and then reminded as well when Apollo 13, when that whole disaster happened. I mean, I can't remember, about 11 or something like that. And we talked it through together, and he was talking about how they were trying to solve the problem. And
to get back safely to Earth.
To get back safely, yeah. And I think, like, watching the movie kind of brought what he had been saying to me into focus. But I think the movie was brilliantly acted, and I also think it showed both the best and the worst of human nature. And I think at the end, it's not Kevin Bacon, who's the guy who's the mission leader? I've forgotten.
Tom Hanks?
No. Oh my goodness, I'm sorry, I can't.
That's the guy. I'm trying to remember it myself.
But somebody says to him, you know, this is going to be NASA's greatest disaster, and he says, I like to think it's going to be our finest hour. And it was. Do you know, it actually was. And it makes me, especially when things are so bad in the world, it makes me realise that there is an absolute font of human greatness still. You know, people can do great things. And so I think for that reason alone, it's a really inspirational movie.
It might have been Gary Sinise was the other actor in that. I might check it.
No, this is the guy who was the mission controller, and I can see him. I can see him in front of me and I know who he is.
We're going to play the famous Houston, We've Got a Problem. We have a problem scene, and then I'll find out while ever listening to that who it was.
Hey, we've got a problem here.
What did you do?
Nothing. I stirred the tanks.
Whoa. Hey.
This is Houston. Say again, please.
Houston, we have a problem. We have a main bus B undervolt. We've got a lot of thruster activity here, Houston. It just went offline. Oh, there's another master alarm, Houston.
I'm checking the quad.
Christ, there's no refresh valve.
Maybe it's in quad.
We've got a computer restart.
I'm going to reconfigure the RCS.
We've got a
when these things
light.
Fire, doesn't make any sense.
We've got multiple caution and warning, Houston. We've got a reset and restart.
All right, I'm going to SDS.
Jesus. Like the heart rates are skyrocketing.
Econ, what's your data telling you?
O2 tank 2 not reading at all. Tank 1 is at 725 psi and falling. Fuel cells 1 and 3 are what's going on here? Flight, let me get back to you.
Flight GNC.
Flight, they're all over the place. They keep going close to gimbal lock.
I keep losing radio signal. Flight, they're in tandem.
22. They're going to have to do it manually.
One at a time, people. One at a time.
Directed by Ron Howard, and it did star Tom Hanks, Kevin Bacon, and Gary Sinise, as we said.
And the person Ed Harris.
Exactly. It's Bill Paxton and Ed Harris for the other stars in it.
Yeah.
A dramatic movie indeed. Musicals. You're not a big fan of plays or theatre musicals, apparently.
Well, musicals particularly not, because, you know, people bursting into song instead of just saying what they need to say kind of just doesn't do it for me.
I'm with you.
And the theatre, although I enjoy going to the theatre, I can never really suspend disbelief enough to get involved in the play as a thing, you know. I find myself looking at the scenery and imagining what's going on backstage and thinking about the lines that the actors are going to deliver, and I don't get involved enough in the theatre itself. So, not great. On the
you
theater.
Did pick one for us, though, didn't you?
I did, and I picked Pygmalion, which is also a musical. So, you know, as I'm probably just the one thing that I've always enjoyed. But I do, in fact, like George Bernard Shaw, because I think all his plays have a particular vibe, which is really, you know, the deserving poor and people meddling in other people's lives and trying to make them better and saying to people, oh, you know, something like a Major Barber, you know, where she's working the Salvation Army, but then she has to morally decide whether taking money from her father, stepfather, who owns a munitions factory, and giving that to the poor, and him, you know, employing poorer people, is that better than her being in the Salvation Army? So there's a lot of those dilemmas, and the same dilemma to some extent is in Pygmalion, you know, where Henry Higgins is trying to turn Eliza Doolittle into something else. So I like that. I like that as a theme in those plays and in his work. And I enjoyed Pygmalion. And he wrote a number of different endings for that, or, you know, as time went on. And I actually did enjoy My Fair Lady, but a few too many songs, I would have said.
Okay, let's move on to television. And recent TV shows. Shogun, is this the new Disney Plus one that's been on recently?
Yes, it's stunning. It is fantastic. I mean, everything about it is brilliant. And I binged that, and I would recommend binging it. Just the whole depiction of Japanese culture in the 16th century and the way it's acted. It was also quite true to the novel, which is quite unusual, I think, in a lot of those series. But it was absolutely brilliant.
Well, in the scene that we have, when a mysterious European ship is found marooned in a nearby fishing village, and I hope I pronounced this correctly, Yoriyoshi Taranaga discovers secrets that could tip the scales of power and devastate his enemies.
My men, I'd like to see them now. Where are they?
実は皆様別の場所にお移りになりまして、あ、でも安全な場所でございます。
I'm sorry, I don't. Look. Maybe you can help me. Here.
Hey, what are you doing?
ご自分の船お行きになりたいようでございます。
What now? Let go. この船はお前のものではない。走りは禁じられておる。
I am afraid you are forbidden from boarding without permission.
My own ship.
If there is something you need.
Well, there is, yes. My pistols and my men. Keep asking to see them.
Your men were brought to Toranaga-sama's city of Edo for their safety. As for your guns, we can fetch them if it becomes necessary.
Now look here, Mariko. Your lord and I had an arrangement. That ship and its crew now belong to me.
You're quite mistaken. Your ship and crew now belong to Toranaga-sama. And he will use them as he wishes.
Well, thank you for the clarification.
Shogun. It's the first time we've played a bit of Japanese dialogue, certainly on this programme. You have other choices as well. Elementary with Johnny Lee Miller.
Yeah, which is the updating of the Sherlock Holmes stories. And I think an absolutely fantastic adaptation and updating. Obviously, Watson is now a woman and played by Lucy Liu. And, you know, it's really interesting that Changing Watson into a woman has not made any difference to the brilliance of the programme, and people who are watching it are very, very happy about it. You know what people kind of say, oh, you can't do this, it's messing with it, and you can't. And the chemistry between the two of them is brilliant, and the cinematography is great. Everything about it is really good.
And then you also have a Spanish cable show.
Yeah, Spanish cable. Well, I do live some of the year in Spain, and so we watch Spanish TV. And this one, Velvet, is like it's like a huge soap opera, but a glorious soap opera, because it's set in Madrid in the 1950s, and it's about a store that high end fashion store. And at the time, you know, some of the staff lived at the store, you know, the seamstresses and everything. And so it's you know, there's love and there's betrayal and there's murders and there's all sorts of things, but it's fantastic. It's just great fun to watch.
Okay, and then from when you were a child, what grabbed your attention?
My favourite when I was a child was the Mary Tyler Moore Show. When I was slightly older, I think, with the Mary Tyler Moore Show, because I wanted to be her, and a load of my friends wanted to be her. She was just fantastic. And you know that scene at the end or the beginning of it, in the title scene where she throws her hat up into the air, it was just such a liberating thing. And it just made me feel that, you know, women could do anything. And she was always having a hard time, but she always came out on top. And
the Mary Tyler Moore Show, I think she played a part with Mary Richards was the title.
That's right, that's right. Yeah.
And that's what Lou Grant was a spin-off from, that with Ed Asner was her grumpy editor.
Yeah.
Let's hear a little bit from the Mary Tyler Moore Show.
You know, maybe you folks can help me out, because there's something I've never understood. I've been going to these award dinners for years, and it's just 2 minutes of glory. Why do people feel badly if they don't win? Isn't it more important how you feel about yourself? Don't you get more from a feeling of self-worth than you do from a silly statue?
I believe I can answer that. No.
Honey, your category is next. And good luck to both of us.
There is no us. Mary just told me what happened between the two of you.
Hey, honey, one kiss. What's the big deal?
Just go away.
Oh, come on, Sue. Don't be silly.
Don't.
Hey, hold it down there. You've got to announce your category.
I don't care.
Please, honey.
Will you please go away?
You heard what she said, buddy. Go away.
Who's going to make it? I am.
Mr. Grant.
I'll handle this. You want to step outside?
Yeah, let's go.
You got it.
The Mary Tyler Moore Show. To finish, Sheila Flanagan, give me a buried treasure, something, anything that you feel people should know more about.
Well, I'm not sure that people don't know about this already, but I've chosen A Convent Garden, Brittany by William Leach, the painting, as my buried treasure. And
Seen where?
It's actually hanging in the National Gallery, which is fantastic. So people can go and see it at any time. I used to go and see it in my lunchtime when I was working in finance, and it used to calm me down after after, you know, a day shouting and screaming. So it's just the most peaceful, beautiful photo. The light is beautiful. The colouring is beautiful. Leach's wife was actually the model in this particular painting. And I think that's kind of amusing, given that she's painted as a novice nun. Yeah. But it is just everything about it is it's kind of charming and peaceful and caring, and I just love it.
Sheila Flanagan, thank you so much for doing the culture.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper, weekdays from 4:30. Today.